One size fits all seemed like a good idea for clothes.
Nice dress.
It's a t-shirt.
Until you tried it on. Same goes for your healthcare. That's why United Healthcare offers a variety of flexible, budget-friendly coverage for medical, vision, dental, and more. So whether you're between jobs, coming off a parent's plan, or even missed open enrollment, you can find the plan that fits you best. Find out more about United Healthcare coverage at uh1.com. That's uh1.com.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hello, movie troopers. Welcome to this week's episode of Troop and Movies. I'm Layla Latif.
I'm Lillian Crawford.
And I'm Sabina Petkova.
On the show this week, a holiday goes up in blazes in a fire, and David Jenkins spoke to the film's director, Christian Peltzold. A precocious child has her independence disturbed by her father's return in Scrapper. And on Film Club, another father and daughter struggle to reconnect in Paper Moon. All coming up on Troop and Movies, a Little White Lies podcast. So, welcome to you both. As I'm sure our kind of listeners with brilliant memories will know exactly who you are, but for those who've maybe had a lot on their mind and can't quite recall, you guys want to introduce who you are? Lillian, who exactly are you?
Who am I? A huge question. I am a freelance writer, write for Little White Lies a lot and various other publications that we won't name. Yeah, that's mostly what I do.
And you technically kind of gotten the prestige of being an official film critic. You have joined our, what is it, a guild? Our circle.
Should we call it a guild? It sounds like a cult, which maybe it is.
It
feels that way, but yeah. I am now an official film critic, according to London, which is a nice thing to be told that one is.
Well, you know, it's one of those jobs that I think always feels like it's a slight madness and not quite real. So it's very nice when people tell you, like, no, this is a thing and this is the thing that you do and it's official.
Yes, absolutely. Because I always tell people that I don't actually have a job and then remember that writing film reviews is apparently a job.
Apparently.
Apparently.
Judging by the money, it's not much of a job, never mind.
Quite.
Sabina, what about you? Who is it that you are?
I am a freelance film writer as well, partial academic, partial programmer too. So I moonlight as both other things. And I'm also now an official critic as of today. So it's a good day for legitimacy, I guess.
That's very exciting. Well, welcome. I mean, I do believe you might get like an actual press badge with it, but you get some stuff, which is pretty fun. Very excited to have the two of you join the cult that is the London Critics Circle and us all kind of maybe chip away a little bit at our imposter syndrome. But yeah, aside from kind of our own professional accomplishments, is there anything that you guys are particularly looking forward to when it comes to the coming months?
Well, I'm very excited about the Powell and Pressburger season at the BFI, which is coming later this year. That's very exciting. And I'm going to be doing some various talks and things around Powell and Pressburger, which is my favorite thing to talk about. So that's all good and exciting. And I have some, I do a lot of the relaxed screenings. I think I might have mentioned this on the podcast before, but relaxed screenings at the BFI for neurodivergent people. So I've started writing a series of pieces about why we have these screenings and who they're for and how neurodivergent people might respond to films differently to neurotypical people, including myself. So hopefully we've got some more of those coming up as well and potentially something Powell and Pressburger related. We will see. I don't want to promise anything yet, but that's what I'm mostly sort of looking at the moment.
Oh, I really love that you're doing that. I mean, a part of a lot of neurodivergence is that you do connect very intensely to art. And so like actually providing people the spaces to like do so, I think is just such wonderful work, Lillian. I appreciate you and everything you do very much.
Oh, Thank you very much. I'm glad it's appreciated.
Savina, what about you? What are you most looking forward to in the coming months? I mean, we could be smug and just talk about how we're all going to be on the Venice Canal soon. But
yeah, it's that time of the year again, especially after I missed last year's Venice. I'm very excited to have the opportunity to return to the Lido again and watch the new Lanthimos film. As a huge Lanthimos head, I cannot wait for also the film's official release, but also in September. It's the month that is going to be quite important for me personally, as I'm co-curating my first big thing at the Barbican, which is spotlighting a very much unknown filmmaker from the 60s onwards. The first Bulgarian female filmmaker, Binka Zelaskova. So we're doing three screenings at the Barbican of three Echver films, two restoration premieres, and one non-restoration premiere. So yeah, if anyone wants to join, I promise you'll love the films. They're just absolutely great.
Oh, that sounds absolutely incredible. I mean, what is it that's kind of like distinct about her work, and why was she overlooked? This sounds like a very interesting
segue. her films were banned actually for 30 years. They enjoyed maybe a couple of days of release, and then they were banned by the socialist regime. And her work was impeded year after year, and only now she's getting some recognition with retrospectives in Greece and in Paris, and hopefully, yeah, this one in London will help us kind of raise awareness and do more restorations of her films, because they are in pretty dire condition. So it's, working with the archive for the first time for me has been super exciting.
It's incredible. So three films you mentioned. Sorry, I'm just going to keep pushing this, because I'm so
please. Just I'm kind happy of
like,
to
literally like just wave the flag for just like, this is what I'm super into, like Bulgarian lost female filmmakers who were banned by their
exactly
governments. What are the kind of the films that you've have for this season at the Barbican? Like, what is it that you're going to be screening?
So one of them is a satire, kind of surrealist drama that is quite funny as well. The other one is a spy thriller, actually. Super beautiful. Think Antonioni style. And the third one is a more playful comedy about a love triangle. So it's quite varied, showcases different stages of her career. And two of them are black and white, one of them is color, and tickets are on sale at the Barbican website now.
I honestly feel like you must be lying to me, because this is just ticking every box that you are just like, you know,
it's too good.
Like a con artist comes along and it's just like, this is too good to be true. Okay, I will see you there.
please come.
Much.
I will be so happy to see you both there.
Oh, definitely be there. Sounds amazing.
But yeah, we should get on to one of the non-banned films that is actually being allowed to be released into cinemas this week. It's A Fire. Join our community of film lovers by becoming a Little White Lies member. We receive exclusive perks and an insider's view into the world of Little White Lies while directly supporting our independent film journalism. Search Little White Lies membership via your search engine and click through to our Steady HQ page for a detailed breakdown of the plans. Now on to the movies. In a holiday home in the Baltic Sea in a hot, dry summer, four young people meet. There is a forest fire, and slowly but unnoticeably, they are enclosed in the walls of flame. Trapped, they get closer, and then desire, love, sex, all overtakes them. First, though, Little White Lies editor David Jenkins spoke to Christian Petzold about his latest film.
Okay, then. Well, thank you, Christian, for speaking to me. I would love to know, like, I think one of the sort of, I guess, a kind of comic highlight of the film is the scene where he's going through the text within this novel Club Sandwich with the editor. And could you talk to me a bit about how much of Club Sandwich did you write? I mean, I've read so many novels like that and had to give up quite soon. But like the text for the novel is so perfectly written. I'd love to just know how you kind of approached that.
Yeah, you know, it's very hard to write a bad novel, yeah, which is not a caricature of a novel. Yeah, you must write a novel, and you must feel that the author of this novel believes in this shit in the same moment. Yeah? And this is very, very hard. Yeah, and so it costs me 1 week. All the others writing of the script was very fast. I must say, I can write script very fast. Yeah. So 1 week, 2 weeks, then I have the structure and so. But this shit, yeah, it was this novel. I have no idea. Yeah? I'm walking through Berlin and like in the time when I was 26. Yeah? It was a totally regressive situation for me. And then I have the idea to take a fantastic novel I love so much and rewrite it as a bad novel. A little bit like what I've done with Edgar Ulmer's Detour when I made Cuba Libre. A little bit like this. Yeah? So, and then I take a novel by Scott Fitzgerald. Yeah? The German title is 10 Years. Yeah? Also 10 Jahre, 10 Years. And it's about a man from New York who's coming back to New York after 10 years. And he wants to go back into the old times of orgiastic parties, fantastic girls. But everybody he meets has a family now, is not interested in orgies, and he knows he's the loneliest person in the world. And this, I love this novel. And so I took this novel and rewrite it in a novel where for Berlin today, with this, all these bad literature here, this ego literature, as if their boring life, when they have written it down, it's great, fantastic life, it's cynical, they're talking about the ordinary people like their shit. I want to see your naked breasts and the sweat between your thighs and all this shit. And so this, and then I have written it down, and it was good. It has a form, yeah. So because I have read it again and again, it started to infect me. Yeah, I like it. Yeah, and when the actors during the rehearsal, especially the guy who's one of my best friends, the editor, he read it, and all the other actors are laughing about. Yeah, I was a little bit. I was really hurt, and as I said the sentence, it's not so bad. Yeah? I'm sorry, it's not so bad. And they start really laughing. And I know in this moment I was free. Cuba Libre is dead. No, yeah? I know this.
That's a wonderful story. I would love to also know, like, one of the aspects that I took from the film as well. Like, I think it's maybe a quite a contemporary thing, and perhaps it's kind of something that's specific to the UK. But in the UK at the moment, there's the government in the UK are, I guess, waging a war against academia and in particular arts and humanities. Like, they kind of want, they're sort of manipulating things and budgets to sort of stop young kids going and doing, you know, literature and filmmaking and, you know, classics and things like that, because they don't see them as valuable, you know, and they're not going to get a job at the end of it. And I kind of love this idea of Paula Beer's character as this slumming academic. And I wondered if there is any kind of wider commentary on the state of academia in Germany, is like that this kind of, this brilliant mind has been kind of, you know, left out to dry kind of thing.
Yeah, I have the same experience in Germany too. I think the reaction of all the people who wants to be artists or intellectuals or people from the academies and universities, their reaction is much worse than the, because now they want to make art you can use. Yeah, it's journalistic art. Yeah, they make movies with a subject. Yeah, it's as if the cinema is just a medium and not something of itself. Yeah, and this I talk so much with Paula Beer because she loved in her character that she is not someone like this. She's selling ice cream. She's working in a hotel. She never suffer. She's independent. She's the subject. Yeah? And she gives a shit to all these and she's writing about Heinrich Heine and about something from the 80s, Significat, Significant, Saussure, Lacan. Yeah? This is everything is inside. This is totally dead in Germany now, because we need art you can follow an idea. We have to make movies about, I said 2 years ago, about lemon trees between Gaza and Israel. And yeah, there is a Palestinian boy and an Israel girl, and they met there with the lemon tree and so, something like that. This is totally shit. Yeah? And so we talked about art. Yeah? We talked about climate catastrophe. We talked about that we have a backlash everywhere in Britain, in France, in Germany, a backlash to traditions, to an ordinary life, which never exists, but they think about. We don't want to have all these queer things and complicated things. We want to have clear structures. And yesterday, when I've seen a movie with my wife, because she can't go to the cinemas because she's editing and she wants to sit at her living room. I like to sit beside her in the living room. And we saw Pursued, a movie by Raoul Walsh. You think it's very simple movie. There's one Robert Mitchum, and he's adopted. So in a family, but it's so complex. And all these people who are said we need simple forms, they destroy everything. But these movies are simple, but so deep. And we are talked more than half an hour after the structure of the movie. And it's the same what Paula Baer said about Heinrich Heine. The subjects are inside the structure. It's the whole building, the architecture of this movie is also the sense of the movie. And it's, you can feel it. It's fantastic. So it was a great evening yesterday.
Well, I mean, on that note, I think it was like a day or two ago, I was reading an article on Variety. Mm-hmm. About there are certain producers now who when they kind of give notes back on films, one of the things they're thinking of is about the fact that a viewer will be watching the film while also looking at another screen. Yeah. And so they're actually trying to kind of make the films so they operate on that dual level, which is terrifying. But I think goes back to what you're saying about, you know, I think, you know, the sort of cinema of classic Hollywood does, you know, it's rare to see a kind of even a kind of, you know, quickie B movie that doesn't have some kind of evanescent richness or depth to it that it's not so common.
You know, in Germany, we have no cinema in our public television anymore. They destroyed it totally. There's no member of our public television, and this our public television is richer than the BBC. We have 8 billions a year, but they never go to Cannes anymore or to Venice because they don't want to buy movies. We don't need movies, so we have so many production of their own, and these are really worse, bad productions. There is no neighborhood to the cinema anymore, because if you would see a movie like this Irish movie, The Quiet Girl, they never bought it. But if you see this movie in a German television channel, all the German shit productions would feel ashamed about this. They put it off. We don't need it anymore because the journalists the journalists are now the people who make the program. They are the curators. And they are looking for themes, subjects. We can discuss later. They make a movie, and after you have a talk show about the subject of the movie. And in this talk show, the actors of the movie are sitting and they're talking about the concentration camps, for example. What is their experience of the concentration camps? It doesn't make any sense. So this is a problem.
Thank you so much. That was brilliant. It's always a real joy talking to you.
Yeah, thank you.
So Lillian, as kind of big and splashy as that sounds in certain ways, that these people kind of trapped in like this inferno, this is very much a sort of character study about the kind of dynamics between these few people. I mean, how would you describe what it is that's going on between them?
Well, I certainly, as you say, I wouldn't characterize this as a sort of towering inferno, sort of forest fire epic, and it's very much not what a fire is. I suppose the best way to describe a Christian Petzold film is sort of as a Christian Petzold film. They're all so extraordinary and unique, and I think the first of his films that I saw was Phoenix with Nina Huss, which is one of my absolute favourite films. And if people haven't seen it or see A Fire and want to see more, that's definitely the one I'd sort of mostly recommend. But he's been working with the actress Paula Beer for a few years now in films Transit and Undine, which are two absolutely gorgeous films. And this one is sort of very much following in a similar vein to those last couple of films, that we have this sort of, there's something sort of encroaching on the characters that is going to, or threatens to pull them apart in some way, but ultimately forces them together and then ends in most devastating fashion. And I end up in pieces by the end of his films. And I think that this one is really, really special. It's very similar, I suppose. The filmmaker that it most reminded me of is Zurich Mermer, particularly The Green Ray, which is another film which I think has been talked about in this podcast quite a lot. And it's just watching these people having these conversations, and as you said, sort of how they come together is so beautiful and so deftly played, which, given that we are in a summer that has been taken over by two very huge and very loud blockbusters, I found it incredibly peaceful and enjoyable to be able to watch a film that wasn't making my head hurt.
Yeah, true. Not that I will disparage Barbenheimer, but it is a very,
I wasn't even
nice...
going to mention the names of those two films.
Well, it's a nice change of pace. I mean, Savita, for you, did you come into this as a fan of Christian Petzold's? Did you have like a expectation as to what this film would be?
Oh, massively so. I was actually thinking about how great that it is that the film is released both in the UK and US in the summer, because it is genuinely a summer film. And the first time I saw it was in dark, snowy Berlin back in February. And it provided me with such hope for love and hope for the summer back then. So it's really good to re-actualize that now properly. It's very fitting, and I'm very happy that they managed to get such a release slot for it. And yeah, as a massive, massive Christian Petzold fan and Paula Beer fan, I'm extremely happy to see the film being received so well and being talked about. And because Undine was probably my favorite film ever, so unfortunately was muffled by the pandemic and didn't get the attention that I think it deserved. So in a way, A Fire is hopefully going to resuscitate that passion that I think is there for Petzold's new work. And he's been working for a long time and has been historically important for new German cinema. But I find such freshness in his latest work that is almost unmatched, I think, in European auteurism today. He really pushes things and does it so simplistically. You know, his films are not complicated. They're actually quite simple, especially visually so. But he does this magic that I'm really looking forward to dwelling in our conversation again.
I mean, there's certainly this particular magic that he pulls out of Paula Beer. And I find myself struck slightly dumb by this and kind of relying on you, Lillian, to articulate what it is. Because it's a sort of subversion of the male gaze. It's a sort of, there's a real spark to her. There's a mystery. There's an unknowability to her. But it doesn't feel like some sort of narrative tool. I don't even know how to articulate it, but like, yes, all of these things sort of come together in like the tiniest Venn diagram into like of six loops with like a little perfect center.
Yeah, I mean, the reason why I mentioned Romare so quickly is because I think with all of Petzold's films, I immediately feel like I'm watching a film which wasn't made now. It feels like something that belongs to a previous era. I mean, Phoenix is very much a film that sort of is taking nods from Hitchcock's Vertigo, and Transit has a lot in common with Casablanca, and Undine is sort of playing with earlier forms of cinema as well. And I think that's what goes on here. And it's sort of, it's almost like we're sort of taken out of the modern world. I mean, this is set, as you said, in a holiday home on the Baltic Sea. So it's taking us away from modern society and really just seeing how the engagements of these kinds of people play out. Of course, Petzold works with Franz Lugovsky a lot, and the protagonist here, the male lead, is Thomas Schubert, who's rather different and looks very different. I suppose he has a different kind of persona. He's not very likable, and I think that's the thing that immediately struck me and sort of concerned me starting to watch this film, is that here his character, Leon, is not he's writing a novel which is called Club Sandwich, which leads to probably the best line reading in a film for years. I mean, Bournebeer is sort of dismissive of this book that he's writing, what it sounds like, and it sounds like a sort of cross between like David Foster Wallace and Thomas Pynchon, that kind of novel writing. And her sort of, that's how I interpreted it. Anyway, I suppose it's open in that respect, but his sort of self-image is so different to what she sees. And I think that the way that Portobello's character, Nadja, she sort of strips that down is just so compelling and so beautiful. And it's done in such a slow, meditative fashion that, as I say, isn't something that we get treated to so much anymore.
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting thing because, like, writers are so often protagonists in films, and I guess that's because writers, like, want to write about what they know. So even when they're writing movies, it's like it makes sense to make the central person a writer and link to their lived experience. But to me, this felt like, I don't know to you, Savita, like, there was something about the sort of self-loathing and insecurity of this man that didn't go too far. It felt very... Sure, he's not likable. I mean, whatever that means, that's normally a tool to kind of use against female protagonists. But I found him deeply compelling.
Yeah, and I think something that Petzold is really good at is distributing the protagonist's power between two characters. As in, we're not sure who is actually the protagonist because there's this game that's almost going on. We think that Leon is the protagonist, but it seems like Nadja is the protagonist in his personal story. So there's this layering of protagonists, and I think that was similar in Undine because she was the protagonist in the film, but actually Franz Rogowski's character was her protagonist, and everything revolves around that. And I think they feed off each other super, super well, even if the film is mostly built on their snappy comments and disdain on Leon's side and Nadia's completely unperturbed, shiny presence. You know, there's this quite difficult to pinpoint their relationship because we witness it establishing itself more and more, and yet we can't tell what's going on between them. And I think that's how Petzold works with actors in a very free-flowing, intuitive way. So they create a mold of two characters together that each one becomes stronger in counterpoint to the other.
I don't want to sound too glib, but yes, Nadja has what I believe the kids call main character energy.
She does, because she gets the work done. She has a job. She goes back, she cooks, she cleans, she fucks. All these things, she has it going for her. Whereas Leon, poor guy, like, he always says, I need to work. But he never does. He just keeps falling asleep, which is something that I think all sometimes can relate to. But definitely not much main character energy on his part, however much he wants it to be.
Lillian, for you, does that all work to its kind of detriment? I mean, we've kind of got this, like, ensemble of people. I would argue that, like, if there was anything that was unconvincing about the film, it's that they would hang out.
Well, I mean, I suppose there's not really much option. I think we've probably all found ourselves in situations where we end up sort of being forced to socialize with people that we wouldn't typically spend time with. And I think that that's the beauty of films.
Of our relationship, sorry.
Really hilarious, very funny. Not at all. But, that's how Romare's films function. There is sort of people forced into a situation where, as I say, they are cut off from urban society and they are forced to interact in these ways. And I think that's, it's a good thing for Leon. And I think I really love films that are about sort of a very someone who's quite curmudgeonly and set in their ways, and then they sort of need someone to tear that down, I suppose. And that's a very old form of narrative, but it's one that works very beautifully here. And it is such a gorgeous film. We really must talk about what this film looks like. It's just this red dress that Nadja wears is absolutely stunning, and is very much a motif that Petzold has used in all of his films. I think I get the impression, I mean, yeah, as as we've sort of, I mentioned Vertigo and Petzold's interest in Nina Hurst and how she's sort of created almost in Phoenix, and then how his last three films have really been about ways of looking at Paula Bear in many ways, which is certainly something that many great directors have done with their leading actresses, and I think it works incredibly beautifully in this film.
Oh, I do just want to kind of do a kind of screen share and watch this both of you, because I'm so enjoying kind of, yes, luxuriating in all that Petzold has given us, but probably wouldn't be very interesting to listeners. So, Serena, is that before we kind of move on to the next film, is there anything that you'd like to say? Any final thoughts on A Fire?
There are no final thoughts on A Fire. A Fire is a film that will live forever in your heart, and it will make you see love in a new way. It will make you cry. It will make you laugh. It is Petzold's probably by far funniest film, and I think it is born out of love, and it signifies, at least for me, the possibility of change and transformation through love. What Lillian said is like a very straightforward narrative technique. I think it acquires political and ethical significance in the way Petzold portrays love here as a transformative force. So yeah, best movie of the year.
I agree.
Wow. That's a high praise indeed for not a time of the year necessarily where people would assume the best movie of the year was coming out.
Mark my words.
So, Lillian, do you want to go with your scores first in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
Yeah, absolutely. I think I'll say in anticipation at a 4, as much as I've adored all of Petzold's films. I think certain cinema fatigue had been setting in. So, but yeah, enjoyment is definitely a 5 for me. I find films like this just so rich and compelling, and there's so much to talk about. I mean, we've barely scratched the surface of how to interpret this film. And I think that, as Savina said, this is perfect for this film to be in the summer. And hopefully the weather's getting better at this end of August as well, so people will be able to come out into the sunshine and reflect on it in that way. And in retrospect, this is definitely a 5, without doubt, the best film I've seen this year. We still have a lot of year left, but I would be surprised if anything topped it for me.
Wow. I'm, as well as being interviewed on this, I'm hoping Christian's listening. What a lovely compliment to receive. Savina, what about you? What are your scores?
Well, I'm not going to be too different. Actually, I'm going to say exactly the same. For me, it was a 4 in anticipation because I adore Undine so, so much that it was difficult for me to conceive something that could actually top it. But I believed in Christian, and he did not disappoint. Delivered a 5 in enjoyment. As I said, it was great watching this film with an audience, the laughs, and also the beauty of sharing Paula Bear space and presence. And in retrospect, yeah, still it's a 5 for me for this year. So far, really, I haven't seen anything that could top it yet.
I think I'm going to go 4s 4 4. Not because, I mean, I will have to rewatch it, and I think that easily could give it a boost. But it's very strange, I suppose, it's because like the 5 is such a difficult score to give, and like to me, I still loved Undine that tiny bit more. But arguably, people could make more than one 5-star film, so I'll double check. I'll go and look. And
You know how frivolous I am with 5s, so that's probably what it is.
Your 5s and your 1s.
Yeah, everything is just good or bad.
Meanwhile, I am a 3.5, most things are basically fine person. But yeah, let's move on to the next film, see if that is a 1, a 5, or basically fine. It's Scrapper.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
A lot can happen in 3 years, like a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage that lasts nearly 3 years in some states. Learn more at uh1.com.
Living alone in her flat, 12-year-old Georgie must confront a reality where her estranged father, Jason, shows up from nowhere. Uninterested in the sudden new parental figure, she remains stubbornly resistant to his efforts. As they both adjust to their new circumstances, Georgie and Jason soon find that they have a lot of growing up to do. So, Savita, this was one of the kind of Sundance darlings. It won, like, very good awards there. And I would say it was an excellent year in terms of British female directorial debuts, and this was just one of them. Do you think that Scrapper lived up to the hype?
I was excited to see it, definitely. And it was very enjoyable to watch, even if I have to say I am not that big on children-led films in a way. I just found myself much more difficult to be convinced by children-led films for some reason, and I'm still interrogating that occasionally with my therapist as well. So I just wonder why that reason is there and what the reason is. But overall, yes, I did find it enjoyable. I thought it lived up to the hype partially. I think in a way it didn't stay with me for too long after I saw it. And I'm not rushing to rewatch it again, even if there was something that captures this particular moment in British cinema and there's something fresh about it. Overall, yeah, I was maybe a bit disappointed. What about you guys? I'm curious to know if I'm like the odd one out.
I have to say I really liked it a lot. And beyond just like children-led films, I personally do not like coming-of-age stories. I find them very, very tedious and overdone. And I also kind of look back on my own life and don't feel that like that was of great enough significance that like cinema keeps revisiting it time and time again. And I have to say, I love the kind of whimsy of this. I really was quite charmed by it. Whilst on paper, it's not really my sort of thing. Lillian, my guess would you less so? I mean, I find it hard to predict with you, but this feels like not a Lillian film.
Sadly, no. And I wish it had been. You said you've used the word whimsy. I keep seeing the word cute used a lot to describe this film. I think it's very saccharine. And that's, it doesn't quite work with the theme and the style that Charlotte Regan's trying to go for. And I think that she's working in a mode of a very well-trodden genre of British cinema, of sort of coming out of the kitchen sink dramas of the post-war period into the 60s, and films that people like Andrea Arnold in particular has done, a better job of making, even when she was sort of starting out with films like Fish Tank. And I don't know, I just, maybe it's because I don't want, I think it's very harsh to be critical of child actors. And I think that it's something that we can describe in the general sense. I have an issue with children being forced to act in films. Well, not forced, but child actors in general anyway.
I mean, a lot of them forced. I mean, we don't need to kind of flip around it. This is an area that needs a lot of scrutiny.
Well, exactly. I mean, the extent to which a child can consent to be in a film is, you know, questionable. And she's given so much to do. She's massively, this character, Georgie, she's so overwritten. She's given a lot of, I mean, I watched this film on my own, so I didn't watch it with an audience, but I really sensed very clearly at what points Lola Campbell was being given stuff to say that would make an adult audience laugh. And I could feel that sort of plodding along the whole way through. I didn't really believe at any point that I was watching a real child delivering this dialogue. It just doesn't feel like something that a child would actually say. So I found its lack of sincerity very difficult to engage with. And I'm not convinced that Harris Dickinson does a great job of sort of as a foil to that and as a supporter of that. That being said, the most charming moments in the film, the real moments are actually the scenes where they don't say anything at all. And they have these moments between the two of them, particularly at the end of the film, when they sort of, there are looks between them, which are really the strongest aspect of this film, I would say, rather than the script. It's also just, it doesn't really have any consistency to it. The visual style is pretty messy. There's this device with using sort of smaller aspect ratio interview shots with some really, really, truly dreadful acting, which I didn't really see the point of, and punctuated the flow of the film that just felt like they were there to sort of stretch it out to 84 minutes. I mean, this is a very short film, and Charlotte Regan is a very good short film director. And I think that she's maybe struggling a bit to work with the feature form in this case. I think there's a lot to like here, but it very much feels like a first feature in ways that I use disparagingly rather than in a positive sense, I think. So yeah, I found it quite a difficult film to engage with.
I think this film might be a bit kind of like sitting next to someone in a dinner party, or perhaps in a Baltic summer home where there are blazers afoot. Like you're either vibing, there's either chemistry, you're either charmed or you're not. And once you've kind of gotten into a position of like not being caught up in its like quirky little personality, I can see how then it just falls apart.
Yeah, absolutely. I think this is what the film lives or dies by, is just how much you're willing to be charmed by Lola Campbell and her performance in this film, which I'm sure for a lot of people will do that. It's just not something that I personally could engage with.
Like Savina, where would you put yourself on the side of this war that has started between Lena and I? Charmed or not charmed by Lola Campbell?
Initially charmed, definitely. But as Lillian was speaking, I was kind of interrogating what my problem with this film and children-led films is, and was thinking that maybe it has to do with point of view, because it does feel like Lola Campbell has been set up to say things that a child would not probably say in a way. I don't know. It seemed less believable and more tailored to a different kind of audience, as Lillian well mentioned. That's the feeling that I had, and that distanced me from the character. And I've been thinking a lot about point of view, children's point of view, specifically in coming-of-age films with regards to Aftersun. I've been dissecting this film a lot lately for some reason. And it's such a fine line between being faithful to a life that is not yours, to a life that is not remembered as a childhood. It's not like, here I am as an adult and I'm sitting down to write the script from the point of view as a child, but I know that I'm an adult. So it's a lot of negotiation that has to go on, I think, to make a character believable. And I'm not sure that this film covered that for me, at least. So it was kind of alienating, even if I found myself laughing and, you know, admiring the snappiness of her comments and the way that she could confront someone who is much more passive, like Harris Dickinson's character. It felt empowering, but also it felt like I was being robbed from the spontaneity of their encounter. So not that charmed in the end.
It is one of those weird things where I think people expect a level of like combat, but like I take on both of what you guys have said, even though I was delighted by it.
That scene at the train platform, that was probably my favorite scene. This kind of playfulness, and it felt as spontaneous as possible, as negotiating their dynamics without actually overthinking it or intellectualizing it. That was the kind of thing that I wanted to see more of, definitely.
Yeah, that's a beautifully put. I mean, I for one am very excited to see what Charlotte Regan does next. And this very exciting new generation of people, like her, Rain Allen Miller, Charlotte Wells, Nida Manzur, like it does feel that we are in quite an exciting time in terms of a generation of new filmmakers emerging. And I will be very excited to see what Charlotte Regan does next. But so, Lillian, please don't break my heart, but what are you going to give Scrapper in anticipation, enjoyment, and in retrospect?
It's good to sort of mention this sort of, I suppose, class of filmmakers who are making these debut features, because I mean it's the same with After Sun, I suppose, in that they're almost borrowing too much from other filmmakers who came before them at this point, and they haven't quite found their voices yet, and we shouldn't put too much pressure on them to do so. I mean, like, applauding After Sun to the extent that we did can kind of ruin it. So I think it's important to say, very good Charlotte Regan, but it might not be there yet. So yeah, anticipation, I would say probably a 3 for that reason. But then enjoyment and in retrospect, I'm gonna put a 2s. This was not a particularly engaged film for me, but I think that there were glimmers of promise that I'll look forward to. But as I said, I think if you're willing to be charmed by Lily Campbell, then it will be you'll have a much better time with it than perhaps I did.
Very fair. Savina, what about you?
I think I'll give it a kind of predictable even score. A 3 3s would be for me. I think that's fair, in a fair way to engage with what the film gave me, how much I enjoyed it, and that it's kind of okay. But very much also looking forward to what she does next, because it's a strong promise, but I would like her to lean more into the intuitive side of things.
Yes. Now, it does in some ways feel a bit kind of unfair when we're talking about a Christian Petzold, like a master filmmaker who's like been honing his craft over decades versus, you know, like a kind of quirky little indie debut. But yeah, I think I'd probably 3 in anticipation, because I'm not a coming of age person, 4 in enjoyment. And then because I'm that kind of critic, 3.5. Most films are basically good. And yeah, that's where I landed with this one. But also I would be very excited to see what Lola Campbell does next. I knew this was her like first role. I thought she was absolutely delightful. And if, as Lillian says, she's not being coerced into acting, it would be very nice to see her kind of explore her abilities further. Next up, it's Film Club. In Paper Moon, real-life father and daughter Ryan and Tatum O'Neill team up with slick con artist Moses Prey and Addie Loggins in 1930s Kansas. When Moses unexpectedly saddled with a 9-year-old Addie to deliver to relatives in Missouri after the death of her mother, he attempts to dupe her out of her money and is forced to take her on as a partner. So Lillian, I know you were absolutely delighted that the film club subject would be Paper Moon. What is it that you love about this film?
Well, I suppose this goes back on what I said about child actors. I suppose I apply a slightly different framework to when I watch older films to when I watch contemporary ones. But Tatum O'Neill's performance in this film is, for me, perhaps the greatest child performance ever, alongside Bicycle Thieves, perhaps the other one. But she's just so extraordinary in this film, and her interactions with her father Ryan O'Neill are just so supremely delightful. I love Peter Bogdanovich. He's one of my favorite directors. And when he died at the start of last year, I revisited a lot of his films. And going back to Paper Moon is just always such a delight. I love the way that they interact with each other. And what I said about sort of the way Harris Dickinson and Lola Campbell interact when they have moments of silence between them is just the whole way through this film for me. The way that they interact with each other is as good as any sort of screwball pairing, as far as I'm concerned. It's just a really delightful film.
And Savina, for you, were you able to kind of get past your I don't want to make you sound like you hate children, but like your dislike of like child protagonists?
my difficulties that are now known and out in the world. It's a struggle. But no, I think this film was really, really a delight for me to watch as well. It was the first Bogdanovich film that I saw. So I came into this very brand new, fresh. And yeah, I really, really enjoyed it. I thought that I wasn't expecting to be surprised for some reason, but I was super, super surprised. It was such a rewarding watch. And frankly, I'm looking forward to rewatching it already. Which is, yeah, I think it says a lot already.
Yeah, it does feel, I mean, like Tatum O'Neill, famously the youngest ever actress to win an Academy Award or an Oscar for acting. And often when that sort of thing happens, you kind of assume that it's just the awards body trying to be cute.
Sure.
In this case, I really do think it's earned.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely. I mean, she performs as an adult. I mean, we see this in her character and the things she does. I mean, like, it's absolutely unthinkable to imagine a sort of a child smoking in bed and sort of the way that she does in this film, which I just think is absolutely incredible. The way that Mose responds to that. And just her sort of the way that she's developing a sense through this film and through the journey that she goes on, because this is a sort of road movie of a fashion, that she's really coming to terms with how she's perceived. And I think it's really beautifully captured how a child's sort of sense of self-image and gender presentation is something that's really explored in this film, and the way that she's sort of developing a sense of self, I suppose, is really incredible. And for a child who's probably going through that experience herself, to have to sort of navigate this material that she's given is really quite astonishing. And as I say, something that I can't really imagine, I don't know, being done in quite the same way before or since.
I mean, it is also just strikingly beautiful in a way that makes you kind of want to do wall collages based on like every frame. I feel like the name Paper Moon is somehow also a very like beautiful evocative image, and like that fully plays out in every sort of frame.
Yeah, absolutely. Especially that scene, the way that the scene is composed of Eddie smoking, with her being fully in the foreground and then him being in the background, and yet the deep focus still encompasses them both. There's something so classical about this composition that is also super, super exciting and controversial, because she is smoking and there's smoke in the frame. I think that's one of the images that is going to stay with me for a long time, because it kind of flirts with something and is saying something very serious about their dynamic without actually saying anything out in the open. Just composition is a super major part of this film in not a protruding way.
Yeah, I mean, there's an impermanence to it, isn't there? There's kind of like that smoky sort of like, this is a moment, this is something that we're capturing in this thing, but there's no real sense that whatever it is that they're building, whatever connection there is, this is like a foundation that truly is going to like form their lives. And I suppose it's like that liminal sense of memory as the smoke kind of dissipates, of like, this may be for Addie something that kind of defines her, but this is not going to be a framework. I guess, so I'm trying, I'm over-therapized, guys.
No, that was beautiful. That was absolutely beautiful, Leila.
But you know what I mean, in terms of like, there is that feeling of like the cigarette smoke that stains your clothes and like your fingers and like feels so intense for a time, but ultimately will come to naught. And as a result, watching this feels like somebody revisiting a formative memory, rather than like the most important thing in their life, or like what actually changed their lives, even though it's kind of left up a little bit ambiguously. Like she feels transformed in a way more that is of memory than of present, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it really does. I think that's a really beautiful and evocative way of talking about it. I suppose the reason why this has been chosen as Film Club is a counterpart to Scrapper. And I suppose what I was saying about Scrapper being this very sort of saccharine and sentimental, but this Paper Moon has no sentimentality. There is nothing sentimental about her childhood. I mean, so childhood is something that you want to shake off in the way that you're talking about it as quickly as you possibly can. Addie's sort of obsessions in this film is with growing up and being perceived as older, but also being perceived as a woman rather than being perceived as a boy, which she is often mistaken for as a child. And those things conflicting, just the way that Tatum O'Neill is able to carry all of that is really quite masterful. And it's so convincing when she's delivering this dialogue and when she's performing these scenes. We absolutely believe that she is existing within that moment, which I never did with Lola Campbell in Scrapper. And I think that ultimately that makes for something more sincerely funny. This is a very funny film in a way that I didn't find Scrapper to be.
If you feel it's a little unfair, comedy. Lillian, to be like the what is arguably the greatest child performance of all time. Look, it's like it doesn't clear that
part. Well, we're comparing the two. This is why this has been staged in this way, and I think maybe I just hold too high standards to people, and I just think that these films are trying perhaps to do similar things and to grapple with grief and the nature of getting older and what it's like to lose a maternal figure and where sort of these girls look for alternative parental figures. And I think that this is just vastly superior as a cinematic example of exploring that kind of processing to the other film that we've been talking about.
I mean, Sabina, for you, I mean, Ryan O'Neill in some ways gets a bit lost in the conversation about this, like before he read up. I mean, is there something about his performance that works particularly well in this dynamic?
I was very interested by the way they established their connection through tricks and trades and money. You know, I was very intrigued by the transactional idea behind their closeness and how they managed to find a way around sentimentality and around the question whether he is or he isn't her dad. And that the shortcut for that was money and accumulating money. And I think that's one of the very few films that deals with it in such a way that it doesn't come off as cynical. And I still don't know how they manage that. It still blows my mind because there's such inventiveness in the way that they talk, in the way that they, you know, scam people together. He's such a neurotic character that makes me like him quite a lot. I think I am up for neurotic dads more than destroyed the Sheldon sweetheart dads. Maybe that's where my allegiance sides it. Not sure why. As well, that's something to talk to with my therapist again.
Yeah, I actually think we could maybe double team this therapist because I think we've got a lot of the same problem.
Let's do it. Poor them. But I think the neurosis he embodies that has to do with his vagrancy, with his nomadism, his ruthlessness. I think that's something that finds a good counterpoint in the relationship he establishes with Addie and his resistance to it as well. Like, he is by far, you know, par excellence the fear of commitment guy anyway. So that was interesting to see how it unfolds in a supposedly father-daughter/accomplice relationship.
Well, again, I just want to talk about this with you guys all day, but we should move on to our kind of little wrap-up of the podcast. So, one last thing, Sabina, what is the non-movie thing that you're going to suggest people seek out this week? What's your recommendation?
I have been obsessed with a certain book called Porn. Maybe lots of the listeners, maybe you know it as well. Polly Barton's book of oral histories about porn. It is something that I haven't been able to stop thinking about. And yeah, very, very inspiring read.
God, for a second, I thought you were going to say porno, as in the terrible train spotting sequel that.
Oh my God.
I'm so
I thought you were just recommending that the listeners go and watch some porn. I mean, sure.
I mean, ethically sourced porn. Definitely do that. But you can start
with
fans
has meant you can pay the creators themselves. I would, yeah.
That is a very good non-movie recommendation too.
So this book, so it's looking at the history of pornography. So where are we starting? Are we going back to Vesuvius and like phalluses that are being carved on walls? Or are we like starting with, you know, the silent movie era?
Yeah, it's quite, what's interesting in this book is that it's structured as conversations. So Polly Barton goes off and has conversations with anonymized people of different backgrounds, sexual orientations and gender and everything to kind of just explore how people talk about porn. And in their conversations, there's a lot of historical things that come up. There's a lot of politics, a lot of gender representation, a lot of personal things people share. But basically, it's the idea coming up to you and asking you, how do you talk about porn with your partner? And how do you do that if you ever do? And what are the reasons you don't? So I think that's a really good prompt to actually help us revisit the preconceptions that we have about porn and our likes and dislikes, pros and cons. So it's, I think it's made up about 20 or more conversations, mostly transcripts, she says, and filtered and edited. So it's really good interview material as well.
Yeah. No, I certainly do talk about that with my husband, but I do draw the line at talking about those preferences with the podcast listeners, so I'll leave it there. Lillian, what about you? What's your non-movie recommendation?
Sorry. Well, I was going to recommend Books of Jacob by Olga Tokarczuk, but I don't want this to turn into an advert for Fitzcarraldo. So I will say that, well, I've been at the proms all summer at the Royal Albert Hall, and I will recommend those because they have been giving me so much joy. It's been such an incredible program this year. And I like to go and stand in the arena at the Albert Hall every night and listen to music from all over the world. And it's just wonderful. It's also broadcast on Radio 3. So yeah, I recommend going and seeing something. It's like £8 to stand in the arena. So yeah, go and try something. There's some, there'll be a few more. It goes on until the 9th of September, so there's plenty of concerts to check out.
Yes, if you, like Lillian, are an enthusiast of music and also have the back that allows you to stand...
to stand every night for 3 hours. Yes. Normally in heels. I normally do it in heels, which probably annoys 20s. The people standing behind me. But
if, unlike me, going on a roller coaster didn't make you have to go have physio.
Well, yes.
Quick, go whilst you can. But no, thank you, Lillian. Your like enthusiasm for this thing is just for these things is just so delightful, and I do hope to. I'll take a couple of Nurofen. I'll come with
no,
you.
No, please do, days. Please do. People should come with me. I do this on my own. It gets quite lonely. But that's a bleak note to end on.
Sorry, no. That was just, I was thinking, should we get into it? But actually, there's not enough time because you know there was that independent thing recently about how like going to the cinema by yourself is pathetic, okay. And actually like fuck those people because I 90% of the time go to the cinema by myself, sure. And it's my preferred way to go to the cinema.
Me too. But yeah,
but we won't get into it because we'll just you'll be here all night. So if you've got thoughts on these films, email truththemovies@tcolondon.com or tweet us at LWLies. Next week, a love triangle gets complicated in passages. Beloved manga is adapted into anime in the first slam dunk. And for Film Club, we return to complicated romance in Jules and Jim. Thanks very much for tuning in. And if you enjoyed the show, please leave us a review and subscribe wherever you get your podcast. Truth Movies is hosted by me, Leila Latif, and my guests this week were Lillian Crawford and Sabina Pekova. The podcast is produced by TCO London and edited by Bob Stankus.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Imagine the softest sheets you've ever felt. Now imagine them getting even softer over time. That's what you'll feel with Boll & Branch's organic cotton sheets. In a recent customer survey, 96% replied that Boll & Branch sheets get softer with every wash. Start getting your best night's sleep in these sheets that get softer and softer for years to come. Try their sheets with a 30-night guarantee. Plus, get 15% off your first order at bollandbranch.com. Code BUTTERY. Exclusions apply. See site for details.